Hello and welcome to Unquestionably Nerdy, the show where we talk about everything that makes us want to geek out, freak out, and set the tone for all filmmaking, good and bad, for the next two decades. I am one of your hosts, Cadden MacArthur, and whom am I joined by?
I am joined by your favorite friend, who is also completely oblivious to whatever is happening today. All I can think of is Charlie Chaplin, maybe? I don't know.
He's out of tone.
George Lucas? Steven Spielberg?
They all set tones.
But I'm still completely wrong. Cadden, why don't you tell me what tone setting you're talking about today?
Well, Cole, today, as nerds, you and I are both heavily familiar with the MCU, perhaps?
Very familiar. I will say I'm not caught up entirely, but I did go, I think, to basically every single MCU movie in theaters up to Endgame. I feel like most children of our time.
I mean, who is caught up nowadays?
If someone is caught up, that takes a lot of dedication.
Dedification.
Yes, dedication to suffer through some stuff.
Well, yes. We all kind of basically understand where the MCU is at nowadays and the effect that the Marvel Cinematic Universe has had, like we said in our intro, on the tone of filmmaking and how films get made nowadays, like with the with Christopher Nolan's Odyssey coming out. Like, there's been a lot of jokes of like Tom Holland behind the scenes or in interviews talking about how the shock of seeing a filmmaker with an actual plan. So that's very heavily where the MCU is nowadays in a lot of people's eyes. And it's, you know, there's still, of course, stuff to love in the MCU. Wouldn't be as successful as it is without that stuff. But today, Cole, I thought, with the biggest event in the modern MCU about to come out at the end of the year, that being Avengers Doomsday, I thought today we could start on a journey of our own, a cinematic journey of our own, in taking some time, taking an occasional episode before Doomsday to review the MCU that we have been exposed to and loved and questioned at times to this point. So today, I figured we could start off, where else but the beginning, with Phase 1 and those first six movies, Cole.
Phase 1 was only six movies?
God, that feels like a foreign fucking concept. The idea that cinematic universes can stick to a schedule that allows them to actually put effort into their movies.
Yeah, I was going to say, imagine actually being able to set up like this big event with only 12 hours of work.
Yeah. Yeah, basically.
I mean, we know much more than 12 hours of work filming the movies, but like, I only need to watch 12 hours on a screen just a single weekend to get like a great story. Insane.
Oh yeah. It really is a foreign concept, because back in the day, we'll talk more about like our reactions to the movies as they were coming out in our youth. We'll talk more about our reactions in that regard. But like, looking back, it is so crazy to think back on the early days of the MCU and realize, like, see how impressive it was at the time, because nobody had ever done anything like it. Nobody had ever had a franchise like this. And when we finally got to see like the Avengers at the end of Phase 1, nobody had any comparable concept to something like this coming out. There's multiple movies leading to this big team up in this way.
I say it's true we had never seen one, and that was pretty epic that we got it. Me being the DC fan that I am, though, remember DC did have the idea for a Justice League movie.
They did.
That George Miller was supposed to direct, that absolutely fell through.
Justice League Immortal?
It was either Justice League, I think it was Justice League Immortal, because the third Tim Burton Batman movie was supposed to be Batman Eternal.
Right.
Yes, but either way, the idea had shown up at least once before within like the decade before they started all of this. Just nobody had actually been able to, like you said in the Tom Holland jokes, actually come up with a solid plan.
Yes. And to that point, like, recognizing the sheer professional nerdism that is Kevin Feige as the head of the MCU for so long, and having produced like a bunch of Marvel movies before this point, a bunch of comic movies before this point, and the fact that Kevin Feige is just a big old nerd, so he was able to see what worked and didn't work in past movies like the Spider-Man trilogy, and I think the X-Men movies he was also involved in.
I want to say that the biggest Kevin Feige movies that he was involved with were the Marvel productions before technically the MCU. I want to say he was involved with both Blade and the original Punisher movie. And Daredevil, I believe.
Yeah, what was God? I'm now pulling up his Wikipedia, and it's all just Marvel stuff, so that's not going to help me. But, yeah, he was around for a lot of stuff. He was around for a lot of this sort of superhero content, which apparently helped a lot in realizing how to build the cinematic universe that he wanted to. But from our perspective, Cole, as we've been around in an audience perspective for so long, since the beginning of these films, God, there are legal adults that were born before Iron Man came out. Yikes.
That is insane.
Yeah, because Iron Man, the first Iron Man movie came out at what point in 2008? In April 14th. In Sydney and May 2nd in the United States. So yeah, there are legal adults who are younger than this goddamn movie. Jesus.
That doesn't help me feel any younger.
Well, Cole, try to escape that feeling and tell me, what do you remember of not just Iron Man itself, but all of these films, seeing them for the first time? Because did you see all of them in theaters as they were coming out?
For at least Phase 1, the answer is yes. I saw all of these in theaters when coming out. I remember having a good time watching all of these movies, except for Captain America. Not because Captain America was bad, but remember, I was still decently young, probably elementary school when the movie came out, and Hugo Weaving, to me, was the modern equivalent of Jack Nicholson's Joker.
That's not a bad comparison.
I did not like seeing Hugo Weaving as Red Skull. I just said, oh wait, that's the bad Nazi man from The Matrix. And then he peeled off his face and I said, nope.
Yeah, that's not a bad comparison. I did not see all the movies as they were coming out. I think the first one I saw in theaters was Iron Man 2, because I remember seeing that post-credit scene with Mjolnir in the crater. And that was like my first exposure to my dad being like, no, we got to stick around. We got to stick around to see what the heck they're going to talk about now that the movie's done. But Iron Man 2 was the first MCU movie that I saw in theaters. And then I saw Thor and Captain America and Avengers of, obviously. And then I would, you know, go back after that point. And like, I saw The Incredible Hulk with Ed Norton, like on a TV rerun for the first time. And then I would watch Iron Man of my own volition as I was like getting into the deeper side of filmmaking as a pretentious 12-year-old.
In terms of the pretentious side of filmmaking, bringing up Incredible Hulk on a television rerun, I do have to mention that Incredible Hulk was the first movie where young Cole's brain as a child said, hold on, that's not Bruce Banner. And I had to come to grips with the idea of recasting.
That's not Eric Bana.
And to this day, this will come up for probably every single episode that we do of all phases. Eric Bana is the best Bruce Banner. And I'm not going to say that Super Green Hulk was the best Hulk. There are arguments to be made, but that one's much less concrete. I will die on the hill, though, that Eric Bana is the best Hulk. And I'm so sad that he never got to touch Phase 1 of the MCU.
Okay. We'll have to return to the Eric Bana Hulk at some point. That'd be an interesting episode, the non-MCU Marvel movies.
It is a glorious, fantastic movie up until the last 20 or 30 minutes when they basically pulled the Spider-Man 3 and said, we had a great time. And guess what? We just threw one too many villains into this movie, and shit, we need to resolve all of it. It was so close.
Yeah, Ang Lee is known for his stylized direction for a reason, but we'll return to that in the future. But in terms of our past with these movies, yeah, I like remember watching Iron Man 2 on repeat on my iPod as a kid. I remember coming out of Captain America: The First Avenger and like being obsessed with it as a kid, and like grabbing the lid off my toy chest and like duct taping it to my arm and drawing a star across the front of it and grabbing like a bike helmet and pretending to be Captain America. Oh, the joys of youth.
That is super epic.
Yes. But we've talked a bit about how we remember these movies as a kid and seeing them for the first time as kids. And we can get on, we can touch a bit more on how these movies compare to the newer MCU as movies themselves before they became more of this massive franchise. But before we do that, I feel like we should get into tackling these movies individually. So why don't we do that? Starting off with, of course, Iron Man, the first Iron Man movie. Not Tom Cruise, but I think the first thing to bring up if we're talking about Iron Man is, of course, what the fuck is there to be said? What the fuck else is there to be said about RDJ, Robert Downey Jr., coming back in almost fresh off his stint away from Hollywood, recovering from his personal business, coming back in with a landslide performance and immediately being the most charming motherfucker in the MCU or any other movie? What the fuck is there left to say, Carl?
Nothing much. This is basically a perfect redemption story for an actor.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think that anyone's ever going to top it in the history books of basically saying coming back from all of the drugs and everything that RDJ had been involved with. I mean, he was an Oscar-nominated actor, if not already won an Academy Award.
He had not won by this point. His first win was for Oppenheimer.
Okay, well, definitely nominated then.
Yes.
And then absolutely crashing, and then coming back and being like, guess what? I'm the face of a billion-dollar franchise.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He is undeniably the face. Like, the cast members of the MCU have talked about it. Robert Downey Jr. is more humble about it, but the fans have talked about it. Everybody has said it. This would not have worked without Robert Downey Jr. This franchise probably would not be what it is today without Robert Downey Jr., genuinely speaking. And you're right, it is like, it's weirdly enough, ironically enough, nicely enough, it is a redemption, not a redemption story, but a comeback moment for Robert Downey Jr. in a similar way to the character of Tony Stark, you know, coming, you know, changing who he is in the public eye and personally. And it was such a risk, right? It was such a risk for this movie to cast an actor who had gone away and been from out of the spotlight for so long. And all of our cautions and questions were immediately put to the side within the first moment in that Humvee where he's putting all of these soldiers at ease, charming them up, talking them up, being their friends. And then immediately everything goes to shit when, oh yeah, the Ten Rings show up and blow up the Humvee with Stark technology. And by God, the Ten Rings are here. I have a note saying, geez, that'll come back in over a decade in a completely separate way.
So I do have to say one of the cool things about the beginning and that I remember as just kind of being in awe as a kid was basically Tony's kind of like Jesus pose with the hands out kind of thing, just as the missiles just blew the cloud over everybody from the explosions. Like 9-year-old Cole felt like that was fucking epic. And I definitely, I think, felt very at ease in this part of the movie. Like, it did not, the thing with the first Iron Man movie is that it did not feel like a superhero movie starting out.
No.
Because it had kind of like that playboy mentality. There wasn't an established villain yet. Because, like, think about it, like, when, like, a Batman movie, a Superman movie, or something like that, there's either a, you already learned this person is special, or there's, you know, some sort of villain amok doing things that will eventually come into play later. None of that was very clear.
Right. You have the Ten Rings nearly from the start, but after he escapes the cave, it's like, they're very much in the background until you realize Obadiah's part in all of it.
Yeah, but I mean, even in that, it just kind of seemed almost like a very, like, kind of like realistic war movie. Because it was, oh yeah, rich billionaires selling weapons in the Middle East and just riding around with soldiers. It almost kind of felt like a war movie for a second. And then everything went to shit with the bombs going off.
Right.
And then I feel like that was the tonal shift of the movie, because then it was Ten Rings time. And it was like, all right, build us weapons. And then that kind of takes to the more survival, and you're like, oh, here it is. Here's the supervillain origin, or here's the superhero origin story. I will say one thing that I think I was a bit too much of a super fan for immediately was that there was a Iron Man movie that had come out 3 years before this one. Marvel had dipped its hand into animation.
Right.
And there was a Iron Man movie about Iron Man having to find like these stones or these rings connected to the Mandarin, because the Mandarin wanted to like raise like some weird elemental eldritch beings to dominate the world. Because of, you know, weird kung fu magic. But this movie came out in like 2005, and I scratched the shit out of this DVD. The amount of times that I would rewatch that movie. It was a fantastic animated movie, and so I already came in knowing who the Ten Rings were, because I'm like, oh, this is the Mandarin. We're getting some cool like magic movie like we did with the animated version. We didn't, so I was slightly disappointed, but I think in it being more grounded, we never would have got just the pure survival insanity of Tony Stark putting scraps together and then saying, guess what? It's armor and kind of a machine gun.
Right.
I always remembered liking the Doctor.
Yeah, Jensen. Yeah.
Yeah. And to this day, like, I remember him, but I don't remember, like, much every time I go back. But I do remember just how epic the escape was when they finally finished the armor and he was just throwing people through the cave and just, like, shooting straight out of, like, his armor. The cave sequence was probably the most epic action sequence for me in that movie.
Right. Yeah, the whole portion of the movie set in the cave is wild, because you switch over to it, like, you start off with the Humvee, and then you get flashback to before Tony leaves America, and then you eventually get back to the Humvee, and then you're in the cave for a good portion of the movie. And it, like, starts off completely throwing you off and not knowing what's going on. Like, that fucking shot of Tony pulling out the breathing cord out of his nose is the most terrifying thing I had seen within the last several days of rewatching these movies. And that, like, Jensen immediately coming in, and you're not sure who he is or if he's a friend to Tony or if he's, like, some mad scientist, like, shoving shit up his nose. But it all plays into not only the horror aspect of the cord and the strange figure and the piece of machinery and the magnet built into his chest, but it plays into Tony realizing the impact that he's having on the world and on people, and it plays so well into how he wants to change his life going forward. And you bring up Jensen as one of, like, almost like this forgotten character in the MCU, which is weird, or sort of ironic. Iron Man, Tony's whole character arc, character change, his whole becoming a hero wouldn't have happened without Jensen encouraging him to, like, see the people on the ground that he affects, and seeing the story of the Walking Dead, the other people with the shard of metal in their chest that slowly creep towards their heart. That story comes from Jensen. And the only other time we see Jensen in the whole of the MCU is in Iron Man 3, in that flashback when they meet at that convention or New Year's party or whatever. But it's almost weird with how, like, self-referential the latter MCU is. It's interesting to look back and realize that one of the strongest players in Tony's personal story as the face of the MCU gets very little look back on.
I mean, yeah, I think it definitely deserves something to look back on, because it was, honestly, I would say just good writing. Like, this entire movie, I feel like there's not really any big memorable characters, like, but Tony, but, like, they all kind of serve their roles in the movie very well. Like, it's just, yeah, it's just tight.
There's nothing about the intentions of making this a larger franchise that distract from this movie. Like, after Tony gets back from Afghanistan and he wants his cheeseburger. Also, you pick fucking Burger King as your first burger back in America? Weird. But
the Whopper?
I guess he really likes Whoppers. It was 2008, I guess.
Everybody will fight over Big Mac versus the Whopper versus, what is it, the Dave's Double or something from Wendy's.
I'll go Baconator before I go Dave's.
We'll fight over that later.
But the only hint early on as to a larger universe, before we get the fucking credit scene at the end of this movie, the first hint at the larger universe and the intentions to make this a larger franchise is Phil Coulson, who's just a very plain, innocuous, nothing character who just keeps coming back and eventually tries to help Pepper fight Obadiah at the end, or arrest Obadiah at the end. Also, speaking of Pepper, she should really contact HR about the fact that her boss asked her to go digging around in his actual body to dig out a wire, and then he goes into cardiac arrest right after that. Pepper should really sue. But I guess they're
not at all.
No, they should. She should.
Okay, so before we kind of get our ahead of ourselves on this, we all know he escapes. We're done with the cool, like, Middle East part for now,
mm-hmm,
until the first kind of reveal of the suit. First of all, Jeff motherfucking Bridges.
Oh my, yeah. How have we not touched on Jeff Bridges so far?
I don't care about the character arc of Obadiah Stane, whatever. He's there. He has his story. He's the villain of this. Mm-hmm. I don't care about the character being the villain. It's the fact that Jeff Bridges, just with his beard and looking so bald, looked so evil to just say, guess what? The villain isn't a man with superpowers. He's just that bad guy.
Yeah. He is an arms dealer. He's an ironmonger. And, like, talking about Jeff Bridges, yes, he is intimidating when he needs to be. He is friendly and charismatic when he needs to be, which plays in a lot to, like, how this movie came to be, because you look at the behind-the-scenes stuff from the interviews and whatnot from when this movie was getting made, and Jon Favreau and RDJ and Jeff Bridges talk about, like, how they would leave set during filming to talk about how to do this scene, and they would, like, basically improv out the scene as, like, because there was no, like, Jeff Bridges talks about how there was barely any script behind it, and the early MCU kind of gets flack a lot of the time for its weaker villains or very replaceable villains, but it opens so strong with Jeff Bridges as Obadiah Stane. It's great. He's great.
Yeah, I mean, I see where the flack can come from weak villains, because I don't feel like Obadiah Stane is, like, a presence among normal Marvel villains. Like, you think of somebody with superpowers that basically has this almost, like, menacing kind of aura of death around him, I would say, of, mm-hmm, like, oh, this man could, like, raise cities or, like, actually cause damage to things. Instead, he was just one conniving motherfucker.
Yep. We get to see that bit of how he's not as in support of Tony at that fireman's ball, that fireman event, whatever, where he first lets on that he's the one who is trying to push Tony out of Stark Industries. That's also where we get to see Stan Lee for the first time as Hugh Hefner. It's also, I like to imagine, one of those valets at the fireman event is Shang-Chi.
That would actually be really cool, but that would make him very young.
Yeah. He's 15 at that time.
Yeah. And I know you brought up Pepper. So one thing that I never really got from the first movie so much,
mm-hmm,
like, was there always that romantic tension throughout the first movie, or was it kind of a thing of it was never there, but then the end of the movie happens and that kind of precipitates some sort of bonding?
I always felt it was there.
You always felt like it was there?
Yeah, because you have the scene at that fireman event where Tony sees her in the backless dress and he invites her to dance and then goes out to the balcony with her, and they're about to kiss, and then he gets called away to go do superheroisms.
Okay, so yes, I get that. I don't know, just...
You didn't think they'd be long-term kind of thing?
Yeah, to me, it always just kind of felt like we were still kind of rolling with the, you know, Tony is a playboy kind of thing. Like, I didn't really get that the long-termness, I think, is the best way to describe it, like you were saying. I never got that was going to be kind of like a long-term thing. I always thought it was going to just kind of be like, you know, the almost like Bond girl of the movie kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I can see that prediction, but also, as you know, it's playing into Tony's shift as a person, where he's actually developing emotional attachments like he's never before, and he's latching onto Pepper in that way because she's a genuine person and doesn't treat him like he's this high and mighty, you know, billionaire playboy god. She banters with him and she goes digging in his chest for him when she thinks he's about to die. But they become one of the longest running relationship in the MCU.
They do. And yep. Let's see. You have anything else, or do you feel like we can kind of move later on into the film?
I laughed when Terrence Howard thought he was going to get to wear a suit. Sucks for Terrence Howard. That weird, weird man. The first use of the chest cannon when he goes after the fireman's ball and he flies out. The fight between the Mark III and the Ironmonger is great. The weight and the presence of the mechanics. Oh my god, we haven't talked about it. We've spent a lot of time on Iron Man, so I'll try and brush through it.
I kind of just wanted to get to the big Middle East fight, because I did kind of want to talk about how epic it was to see the suit in action for the first time.
Yes, leading into that, the suit-up scene, when he gets back from the fireman's ball, before he left, he told Jarvis, nice to hear Paul Bettany's voice and not see him on screen, even though I love Paul Bettany. That felt like a slight against Paul Bettany. Love Paul Bettany, but it's still need to see him as Jarvis and not Vision.
Paul Bettany also needs to come back, though, as White Vision for those who aren't caught up. Watch WandaVision. But yes, Paul Bettany has been the, I would say, minor face of all of the MCU right behind Tony Stark. He's just kind of been in the darkness.
Basically. But before Tony goes to the fireman event, he tells Jarvis to start putting together the suit, and then he gets pissed at Obadiah for being the one to get him out of Stark Industries, and he goes up. And this movie so heavily and nicely has what the recent MCU has lost almost completely, that physical presence of the suit and seeing each gear and wire and plate getting locked and screwed into place. It feels so physical. It feels so present in the way it doesn't anymore, because it's all CGI and nanotechnology after Infinity War. God, it feels good.
Wait, you're saying you actually liked when CGI was used to enhance practical effects and not just, I don't know, do everything?
Can you even imagine, Cole?
I cannot. That is the craziest thing I think I have ever heard.
Mm-hmm. Wild.
So yeah, I was going to say, the suit-up scene is just epic.
Oh my god.
Also, everybody with the superhero pose, like everybody knows what the superhero pose now because of how that man landed.
Yeah.
Like, that is just stained in everybody's memory.
That is the superhero landing.
So I think that was great. I really don't have much more to say about the movie other than I feel like the third act and like the big Ironmonger fight like served its purpose. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it was the most epic of the fights that were in the movie.
Okay.
I do like the fact, though, that this goes to one of the greatest facts about the MCU, which is, I believe, as of, I want to say, either Far From Home or Endgame, Pepper Potts had killed 11% of the MCU villains.
Oh my god.
And I think that the fact that this movie just, in my mind, goes to serve the purpose of having that be a fun fact down the road.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, I'm like, the ending works, yes, but also the most important thing it did was give us this fun fact 20 years later.
Well, Pepper's a murderer. Yeah.
Yeah, 18 years later, sorry. So it's not that old yet.
Mm-hmm. Not yet.
But yeah, I think that...
And she kills him with a blue sky beam, because it was 2008.
I mean, you had to.
Had to. It was legally required.
But But yeah, so again, I also think that the fact that the first movie in the MCU ended with so much death was a big thing. Because it's kind of like, oh, this is the MCU. People kind of see it as the kind of like golden child kind of compared to DC in terms of like it can never be as dark. And it just comes out and says, no, we're killing our first villain because why not? So yeah, I really liked that. The little glimpse of Coulson that we got, not enough. I mean, Clark Gregg is amazing.
Clark Gregg's awesome.
And then of course the post-credit scene. You have a post-credit scene.
Yeah, not a big thing in other movies before this point.
The only thing that we were missing from the post-credit scene, I think, was probably the single worst travesty of the movie. Was that Nick Fury did not say something along the lines of, I want to talk about the Avengers Initiative, motherfucker.
Motherfucker.
they really decided to hamper the man with that.
Yeah. The end of this movie, like the rest of it, so heavily sets the tone with two major lines. I am Iron Man, and I'm here to talk to you about the Avenger Initiative. Stamped into history. I am Iron Man set the tone of, we're not going to do the thing with secret identities until Spider-Man comes around. Everybody's out in the public. Everybody knows that superheroes are a thing and who they are, and that's going to feed into like the presence of them throughout the universe that these movies take place in. And then I'm here to talk to you about the Avengers Initiative. What the fuck? This was supposed to be a standalone movie. Audiences had no idea what was happening. Audiences had no prep for the fact that we're actually going to try and see the Avengers at some point.
I honestly forgot about that prep. Well, sorry, not prep. But that press conference at the very end, I don't know how I glossed over that, but yeah, just ending and coming out with it and just saying, me, Tony Stark, I am Iron Man. And you're like, hold on, this is superheroes. There are secret identities. What the fuck?
Yep.
Yeah. It really hit with its ending in a way that there are some where it's not like the nice slow ride off into the sunset. And this one just said, one-liner, mic drop.
Yep. Well, we have spent a lot of time on Iron Man in this episode where we're supposed to get through six movies. So I honestly feel like we could talk about these individual movies even more. Maybe we'll do that in the future. But I think for now, we have set up the rest of these six movies as the first movie did itself. So let's move on at this point to the Hulk, the Incredible Hulk.
It's still not my Hulk movie.
I understand. This movie, even this movie agrees with you to some degree. Like, this movie can't trust that audiences won't understand that this is different from the Eric Bana Hulk and the Ang Lee Hulk. So they have to go through the origin story in a flashback right at the start of the movie. During which, that same flashback, I made a note that, man, Harrison Ford looks different in this movie.
I mean, yes, it is because it's William Hurt who,
yes,
I think, died, what, like a year before they started filming for
Brave New World, yeah.
Brave New World, which, really sad. He was a really good Ross.
He was. He was a really strong start to the character,
I think that, I really think that they kind of had it down with the villains in The Incredible Hulk.
Okay.
I would say, arguably, from a superhero movie perspective, it was a better villain than Iron Man.
And you're talking about how Bruce Banner is the villain in this movie because he kills Stan Lee with his radiated blood.
No.
No?
No. I'm talking about Tim Roth and...
Oh, okay.
I can't remember the other guy's name, but he was...
Tim Roth and...
He was one of the guys from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? No, you're missing the leader.
Oh, the leader. Fuck. Tim Blake Nelson.
Yes, Tim Blake Nelson. Yeah. But yeah, you had the leader, who was technically more of like a secondary villain in this movie, and it was more Abomination.
Yeah, yeah.
But Tim Roth as the Abomination, still great. Tim Blake Nelson as the leader in his role, great. William Hurt,
who we also won't see till Brave New World.
The casting of this Incredible Hulk movie was just absolutely solid.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I like the story.
What about the story?
it just felt like a fun Hulk movie to me, man. Like, I really didn't care about the plot. I just wanted you to get to a point where you said, there's a villain, Banner has to get angry.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
all those Brazilian bullies.
Kaiju fight.
Okay, different villains, yeah.
Okay, so actually, I will say that the Brazil opening to the movie, mm-hmm. I did actually like, mm-hmm. because I'm only comparing it to how Banner shows up in the Avengers,
right?
Which we'll get to.
Yes.
And I have so many problems with that, given that the Incredible Hulk set it up. Yes.
Okay.
Because the Avengers was like the whole like goat farm kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard for me, based on the previous two movies, and still thinking, yes, this 2003 Hulk is just the first movie, and this 2008 one is a sequel.
Yeah, it was like labeled by the producers as a requel, like a reboot and a prequel, or a reboot and a sequel combination, where it's not a direct follow-up, but it feels very much like it is.
Yes, and kind of from that, again, it's been forever since I've seen this one, but I have fond memories. I have seen it within this decade.
Right.
But I don't remember the ending of this movie really setting it up to kind of be a, I'm going to go even more into hiding than what I was initially at the beginning of this movie, which is mm-hmm. why the third retread, when mm-hmm. Edward Norton gets recast, pissed me off so much, which we can talk about that later. But
sure.
I don't think Edward Norton was the best Hulk or best Banner.
I agree.
I do have to give credit to this movie, though. I think the Incredible Hulk had the best Hulk design.
Okay. I can see that.
I think it did a better Hulk design than the Avengers and later MCU.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he has, like, such a cool introduction. Kind of in a similar way to how we first see Banner Hulk out in the Avengers. But obviously this movie did it first, where it's very much like a horror movie. Harrison Ford, Thunderbolt Ross's agents are tracking down Banner, and they're running through the streets of Brazil, and they get back to the factory, and all those Brazilian bullies are chasing after him too, and you see him start to transform in the shadows and pulling them into the shadows and throwing whole tankers at the bullies and the agents from unseen locations because he's all behind all this machinery and shit like that. It feels like a fucking monster movie, which the Hulk should in a lot of ways. Like, you have recent comic stories like the Immortal Hulk, where it really gets into the body horror of this character, which plays into like the tragedy of the character as well, because he has to go into hiding and has to, you know, calm himself and hide so much of himself to protect people.
There was a sense of dread, I guess, in the movie.
Yes.
Where, and I think this is something that still holds high in my heart, is mm-hmm. that the Hulk and the Incredible Hulk seemed a lot more careless compared to any other MCU rendition. In the fact of, you know, the rage.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you get multiple instances of the Hulk basically going berserk throughout the MCU, and the only thing that stands up to this movie, I think, is the 5 to 6 minutes that we get of the Hulk Buster
mm-hmm.
in later movies. I feel like that's mm-hmm. really the only part that stands up to the Hulk being like this invincible kind of piece of carnage.
Sure. You see, we'll talk about it more in the Avengers as well, but you see him like taking down the Leviathans, but we don't see, that's less of like us seeing the impact he has on his surroundings as well.
Yeah, I think that's less kind of on the surroundings. I think this movie did a good job of, one, he is a hero, but also he's doing a lot of damage. He is a danger.
Yeah.
The last big thing on this movie, I guess, for me, if you want to go more into detail with certain scenes, but Edward Norton is my second favorite Banner.
Okay. After Eric Bana.
After Eric Bana. And I do think that it was a hard role to kind of succeed Jennifer Connelly for Liv Tyler. I kind of feel like that was almost the one weakness to this movie, is that Liv Tyler and Ed Norton as Banner and Ross wasn't a super strong pairing for me.
No, I like all of those actors, but I have to agree, like, there's not a ton of chemistry, ironically, science, between Bruce and Betty. I like Ed Norton, and I like Liv Tyler, and I like Thunderbolt Ross, blah, 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 William Hurt. But yeah, there's not a lot of connection between Bruce and Betty that would make you understand, like, why she throws away her safety and her security and everything to go with him when he shows back up. And there's not a lot of, like, father-daughter connection between Ross and Betty.
Yeah, I really think that I have not seen Brave New World, so I don't know how Liv Tyler plays into that movie, even though I know she is in it.
Mm-hmm.
If she somehow redeems the role of Betty Ross,
yeah,
somebody let me know.
Also, how dare you cuck Ty Burrell?
What?
Do you not remember Ty Burrell being in this movie?
Oh my god, he was her boyfriend.
He was her boyfriend that got cucked. Also, apparently a fair guy because he challenges Ross when he still goes after Banner after the college campus transformation. Which,
actually,
shout out to Ty Burrell.
You know what? I'm going to bring this movie. I was probably going to say this was probably like a C+, B- movie if I were to rank it. Mm. I'm going to bring it just straight up to an A tier for the inclusion of Ty Burrell. I forgot about that.
Fair.
Epic, man. Epic role.
Yeah.
Should have been in the MCU more.
I do have a note of I'm now imagining an alternate universe where Ty Burrell got cast as Bruce Banner, and I kind of love it.
That would honestly be hilarious.
I'd kind of love it.
I think one of the things that I feel like Ty Burrell, if we're just doing the quick fan cast, could you imagine that man as Howard the Duck?
Oh, I can now. And now I can't stop.
I'm just saying, we need another Howard the Duck movie.
I'm into that. But yeah, how dare you cuck Ty Burrell? Ty Burrell deserves better. But also, yeah, like the chemistry between Bruce and Betty, not the best. And honestly, maybe Bruce should have just stayed in Brazil with that one Brazilian chick who's apparently into him, because when he's being chased by the agents, he's totally fine with him climbing into her window while she's half-dressed and he's hiding from the authorities.
Say, everything about, I feel like, how the plot worked out in this movie led to the idea of Bruce should just go back to Brazil. They realize if they try to go after you, you will kill them all.
Yeah.
So just go sit in Brazil and form a nice Brazilian family.
Yeah. I guess he can't make a family because even though stuffing a thumb drive down his throat and vomiting it back up somehow does not drive up Bruce's heart rate enough to make him Hulk out, having sex will. Sucks for Banner, I guess. Makes his life worse. Life already sucks. Got worse.
Absolutely crazy. Just absolutely crazy. Also, yeah, I forgot about the heart rate thing. It made sense.
Yeah, he spends this whole movie tracking his heart rate.
It made sense at the time, but now I don't really like the fact that it's just his heart rate that makes him Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it should be kind of attached to, like, emotion.
Sure.
In some respects, because, and this is something, audience, if you've never read this, I believe it's a comic called Hulk the End. That's about basically a post-apocalyptic thing with a 100-something-year-old Banner and the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they kind of just like freely converse with one another, and Hulk can take over when he needs to. I realize that that probably wasn't initially how the Hulk was established, and that came after, you know, like many arcs of how the Hulk personality changed. But I kind of wish it was more of a, I guess, not directly relatable to science way in, sure, in which he turned. I wish it was just kind of a, when he needs the Hulk, when he gets angry, he can turn into the Hulk kind of thing. But then it's hard for him to get out of it because it's the Hulk now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This movie does play into, like, it plays into, like, how sad he is, but it doesn't capture a lot of, like, the underlying anger that the character of Bruce Banner has in, like, the comics and the Eric Bana Hulk and parts of Ruffalo's Hulk. This movie does an overall good job of displaying the burden that the Hulk has on Bruce, and, you know, Ragnarok and Onward definitely loses that. But we'll get into that in later phases. But, yeah, there's a lot lost in that regard.
And I guess to kind of end the conversation on the Incredible Hulk, remember, everybody, the post-credit scene was Ross meeting with Tony Stark. And it feels even more just kind of out of left field, given that Hulk was recast. Like, if you go back and watch this movie, especially before Brave New World had come out, you really would not consider this an MCU movie until you see Robert Downey Jr. in the post-credit scene.
Yeah, very much so.
My personal feeling, it's not an MCU movie. I would never include it in an MCU lineup because I think that there's only one MCU Hulk. That's Mark Ruffalo, whether I wanted it to be Mark Ruffalo or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, strong opinions. That will lead us into our next movie in Iron Man 2. So Iron Man 2, in the early days of the MCU, one of the lower points that people point out. Do you have an immediate opinion on that?
Iron Man 2 is probably my low point of Phase 1.
Okay, I can see that.
Only because Iron Man 3 is not in Phase 1. I think that, weirdly enough, both the Thor trilogy and the Iron Man trilogy, we're going to talk about the first Thor in a minute, but the Iron Man trilogy and the Thor series, I forgot, Love and Thunder, at least for the first three movies, go down a consistent pattern, which is decline.
Okay.
Each subsequent movie gets worse. And I feel there were still likable moments for me in Iron Man 2.
For sure.
Which is why I still probably consider Phase 1 one of the strongest. Because Iron Man 2 was not a bad movie. It was the low point of the phase, which I will agree with, but it was not a bad movie. We've gotten so many more bad movies.
I think there is such an argument to make. I think you could still argue to this day that there's not a overtly bad movie in the MCU. There have been lower points, of course, but I think you could make the argument that even to today, there's not a really bad movie in the MCU. Opinions will differ, but yeah, I don't think that Iron Man 2 is a bad movie at all, and I think that it has some really strong points to it, to be sure. Like, it has the hilarious opening where they cut Terrence Howard out of the I Am Iron Man scene in that TV screen where Tony said it in Mickey Rourke's apartment. But speaking of Mickey Rourke is here, and he's the main villain for this film, and I think he's one of the examples that people will point to as, like, the weaker villains of the early MCU, and I think there's potential in him. Like, Ivan Vanko has this interesting introduction where he has this motivating loss in his father, like Tony had in Yinsen, and he built his own mini arc reactor in similar conditions to what Tony built his in. And we see his super villain origin story starting in the same low point that Tony had his superhero origin story in. And then, for the point of comparison between Ivan and Tony, we immediately then cut to Tony on the top of the world in comparison to Ivan, with Tony at the Stark Expo, where I know Peter Parker is somewhere out there.
Yeah, I know, I've heard that theory that the kid that we see later is Peter Parker. I feel like someone...
confirmed by Feige.
Yeah, I know, he confirmed it. So, and this is going to be a very hot take. I'm not saying that the actors were better, but I do think that the villains of Iron Man 2 were better villains.
Okay. Between what?
Between
what movies?
Between Ironmonger, Obadiah Stane, and Whiplash and Justin Hammer. I feel like Whiplash and Justin Hammer were better.
Okay. Well,
now I'm not saying
thank
that,
God for,
like,
Sam Rockwell.
Yes. So part of that is Sam Rockwell really took Justin Hammer beyond what Justin Hammer could be.
Yes,
and I'm not
wholeheartedly agree.
I'm not saying that they add together both Whiplash and Justin Hammer to beat out Jeff Bridges. You really cannot beat Jeff Bridges, but that is only because he was Jeff Bridges.
Fair,
right? Like, I feel like you could have recast the villains in 2 and still had a pretty good movie, and if you had a different Obadiah Stane in the first movie,
okay, yeah,
things could have fallen apart.
I can definitely agree with that.
So I think that's more what I'm saying is, like, from the actual, like, character storyboarding,
mm-hmm.
the second movie had better villains.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. The
execution,
and the skill of, yeah, the execution of Jeff Bridges in Iron Man 1, like we said, is like those three in Downey, Bridges, and Favreau working together to figure out how these scenes were going to work and these interactions were going to work and who these characters are. Yeah, bringing in the Downey-ness and the Bridges-ness into that first movie is what made those characters, to be sure. And Rockwell kind of does the same, though I'm sure they had more of a character built out going into the movie. But Sam Rockwell is so much more eye-grabbing throughout the movie. He is a joy to watch. Between that court hearing scene and the scene at the end where he's introducing the hammer drones and the scene where he's selling all the weaponry to Rhodey after Rhodey has stolen the suit. Yeah, Rockwell is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Also, speaking of that court hearing scene, not realistic at all. The court hearing is so doesn't feel like a court hearing, but it works because Tony and Justin Hammer are both using it to play to the paparazzi, which I feel like that just works.
Yeah, I think the court scene worked fine. I do have to say, though, one of the things that sticks in my mind for this movie when I think, hell yeah,
mm-hmm.
Is Whiplash's introduction at the Monaco Grand Prix when he just goes fucking ham on the car.
Yeah, that's a cool scene. It's a cool scene throughout.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah, Mickey Rourke as Whiplash. There's more to be desired in the character. Like, this movie introduces and starts off with a theme of legacy and what comes before and after us. There's a lot missing in that character and how that character could have played into that theme of legacy, because Tony is coming off the legacy of his father and trying to make good on it, and Ivan is doing the same. Mickey Rourke as a physical presence is great, but there's not a lot to the character. There's not a lot to making the character itself memorable, or the writing around the character memorable. Like, the movie gets so confused over what the fuck Ivan is trying to accomplish. He wants to smear Tony's name and make it so people don't believe in him anymore. But there's the confusion between those concepts of legacy and the language that they decide to use of making God bleed and sharks in the water and shit like that.
Yeah, it was, there was something to be desired in Whiplash, mm-hmm. but I still don't think mm-hmm. that he's the worst we've seen.
No. And we also get from Whiplash that Monaco race scene, which also gives the fucking briefcase suit, which is amazing. I love it.
Yeah. Let's see. Next thing that I kind of remember, which I think is an underlooked part of this movie, but to okay. me was one of the best subplots that we've gotten in a Marvel movie. The replacement of the core. Do you remember how, like, integral to the plot of this movie it was of I'm slowly poisoning myself?
Yeah.
That was actually a really good subplot. Like, criminally undernoticed.
It feels like they're trying to touch on, throughout that subplot a lot, it feels like they're trying to pull inspiration from the Demon in a Bottle storyline as he's, like, slowly destroying himself, and it's affecting his responsibility as Iron Man, which then, of course, leads into Rhodey needing to take over, but this time in a more forceful way compared to the comics.
I truthfully am not very familiar with the Demon in the Bottle. I thought that was the whole Tony Stark as an alcoholic arc, which, yes, definitely still kind of plays out in this movie of he's a bit too reckless.
Mm-hmm.
I don't honestly know if the introduction of Nick Fury and Natasha Romanoff
mm-hmm.
To this movie, it was cool because it set up the larger universe. I don't really mm-hmm. know if it was exactly needed or if, like, there was a massive benefit to mm-hmm. them being in the movie.
Yeah.
Because they did just kind of have Coulson in the movie for part of it, and then he says, oops,
right.
gotta go.
Gotta go to Nevada.
You could have just
or
had...
New Mexico?
New Mexico.
New Mexico.
You could have just had more Clark Gregg.
You could
have. And just said, Agent Phil Coulson, here to save the day.
in a sexy leather outfit?
Okay, look, the sexy leather outfit.
Non-negotiable. If Clark Gregg has to stay in this movie, he has to wear a sexy leather bodysuit.
I'm pretty sure that's the reason that most people are okay with the whole Nick Fury and Black Widow part. Other than yes. giving us the scene of Tony Stark sitting on the donut.
Yeah.
That felt so out of place to me in that movie, but also so epic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is the first case of the singular movie that should be more standalone getting distracted by the necessities of building a larger cinematic universe.
I do think so. I honestly think that, as we'll see in a minute with Thor introducing Hawkeye, they could have had a Black Widow movie sooner.
For sure.
They could have had like an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. movie. Where it was, say, Clint and Natasha doing whatever weird mission they talked about in Avengers, which was the same mission that they did the 2020 Black Widow movie off of, or was that a different mission?
They're talking about Budapest during Avengers, which Budapest is like a mission that we never see on camera, but they also like bring up in Avengers, like Dracov's daughter, which we do hear about and see in the Black Widow movie after Endgame.
So yes, they could have showed us that operation in a movie to introduce Natasha and Clint, and then, you know, show that Clint goes off into, you know, going for the Thor movie and his minor role in that, and then Natasha just have less of a role in Iron Man 2, but like still be there to connect it.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, you know, the post credits to that could have been, I'm sending you on a new mission, go undercover for Tony Stark.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, especially with the speed they were trying to get to the Avengers movie, it worked out. Maybe the movie could have had slightly less Avengers building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll see. We'll talk more of it. We'll talk more about it during our discussion for Avengers specifically. But looking back, before I rewatched these movies for this episode, a lot of people like kind of, I feel like there's like a lot of confusion and questioning as to like what the relationship between Tony and Nick Fury and Natasha is before the Avengers, because like we see Tony is the first one brought into the Avengers initiative outside of S.H.I.E.L.D. at the end of Iron Man 1, and then he's like actively recruiting for them during the post-credit scene of Incredible Hulk, and then they're like going at it and bickering between the two of them during Iron Man 2, and they kind of leave it in a weird place of like, we want Iron Man, but we don't trust you kind of thing.
It is kind of confusing how they do leave the end of that movie with the we don't trust you as kind of like an agent, but we'll call you when we need you kind of thing.
Right. And I have thoughts about that now that I've rewatched the movies once we get to Avengers, but we'll save that for our discussion for Avengers.
Yeah. The only other thing I have big note of this movie, of course, you replace Terrence Howard with Don Cheadle.
I was going to ask your thoughts on that.
I personally like Terrence Howard better. I get that people like Don Cheadle. I think that this is Don Cheadle's best that he does in the role. I think that even if he did better in Iron Man 3, I ignore it because it's Iron Man 3. I think that he does himself no service in Captain America Civil War, and maybe in like Avengers Endgame he gets better. Don Cheadle's high point is this movie.
I can agree with that. I can agree with that. This is where he's most front and center in any of the MCU. And I will never complain about Don Cheadle being in anything. I feel like the majority of the people out there, if I can speak for the people right now, I can't imagine anybody will agree with you on that Terrence Howard opinion, myself included.
I don't think most people do.
No.
That's probably just one of my top MCU hot takes, if not my hottest take of the MCU.
I just feel like Don Cheadle plays the stern but caring best friend and soldier better than Terrence Howard did. Terrence Howard never really feels like a soldier, and he just kind of feels like he feels like a parent to Tony more than Don Cheadle feels like his friend.
I guess. Again, I think I would really just need to watch all three Iron Man movies within like a 8-hour span.
Maybe.
In order to just write a thorough, like, 5-page essay on this.
And I believe you could.
But I think just as a character, without really judging their interactions with others, I think Terrence Howard was a better roadie. I think that's something I have to look into more, is who had the better relationship with Tony if we're talking about a best friend.
Maybe. But this movie with Rhodey also gives us the Tony v. Rhodey fight during Tony's birthday party, which I think continues to be one of my favorite one-on-one combat scenes in all of the MCU. And I'm surprised in all of the callbacks that the latter MCU makes, I'm kind of surprised that they never bring about the bring back the Repulsor v. Repulsor beam explosion in any sort of combat. I feel like that'd be a really strong callback to make and a cool battle tactic to use.
I don't know. I think it's only a one-time thing.
Maybe.
I feel like it was there just kind of more for the surprise fun factor.
Yeah. Well, Don Cheadle obviously plays a big part in it, and we get to see the two of them come back together after their fight when Tony starts to fix himself and realize how far he's fallen in, and the foundation he can build on now that he's starting to fix his vision of his father and his past after Fury gives him all the records of Howard Stark. And that leads us into the final scene after Tony has built that new chest piece and he's ready to fight Ivan again now that he knows he's alive. And we get to see a very excellent realization of the War Machine design. And that leads into the final scene between Rhodey and Tony versus Ivan and Hammer getting arrested and the wrapping up of Tony and Fury having their discussions about where Tony stands in the Avenger Initiative, and quick hello to the map of randomly placed locations of interest behind Tony and Fury during that conversation. You'll be at the you'll be in a lot of conspiracy theory thumbnails for the next few years.
Very true. I think my last thoughts on this movie, Justin Hammer deserves to come back. I don't know if Sam Rockwell is going to be in Armor Wars, but
if that ever gets made,
if Armor Wars ever gets made, they should definitely bring back Justin Hammer. And also, given that we now have James Rhodes back in the MCU, if you never realized that he was gone, oh boy, you have some catching up to do. I won't spoil that.
Oh yeah, that.
Yeah, good luck catching up, and Armor Wars is your opportunity to actually give us a good Rhodey story.
Good, good. But, hey Cole, remember when Mjolnir was a big reveal?
Hell yeah. Love that hammer.
Yeah. Meow meow!
Kenneth Branagh should have directed an entire trilogy of Thor movies.
I'm not opposed to that idea.
Thor movie was epic. Tom Hiddleston was great. Seeing Thor in a, like, coffee diner before he absolutely gets beat the fuck by some weird, like, shredded executioner T-1000. Thor is great. I love the first Thor movie.
Yeah.
Casting was great.
Kenneth Branagh is I think I agree with you. Kenneth Branagh is a great director. He brings that Shakespearean vibe that he is known so well for. And also, I think he handles the action really well too.
Yeah, the action in this movie was just really good, because I don't feel like the action was of an epic scale, but it still felt epic.
Yes,
like, the action was very contained, but still like heart racing.
You can see the sets around them and kind of tell that they're sets, but they feel so otherworldly and sort of a lot of the times in that sort of Jack Kirby-esque science fantasy vibe.
Yeah, I think Asgard was great.
Yep.
I think this one was just another example of just a stellar cast across everybody in Asgard and everybody on Earth on the ground.
Oh, yeah. These Shakespearean actors bring a weight to the MCU that not a lot of performances have in the MCU, especially nowadays.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I did like the most about this movie, because it brought in a similar stance to the first Iron Man movie, is there was definitely a chunk of this movie where Thor wasn't doing jack shit.
No, but he had that winged helmet, and I kind of wish he kept it around.
He should have kept the helmet. I think we all want the
I think
helmet
so.
back.
I think
But
so.
like, there was that portion where it's like, this man doesn't have the hammer. He's going to have to break in to this basically shield containment, and then he gets captured. It was action, but not on the scale of like, this entire movie has to be Norse god with hammer absolutely wrecking through frost giants and basically every mythical creature known to man. And I feel like that was the right way to start off Thor. I feel like kind of the whole like fallen god angle was just a great plot.
Yeah, it's kind of a similar start to Iron Man, where he has to learn the errors of his ways, and even like his first moment with Chris Hemsworth and his dyed eyebrows comes into play in the coronation scene, being interrupted by the ice giant break-in. And I feel like that's such a strong start, because after the Jotuns are dealt with, Odin gives him that test of what would you do in light of this break-in, and Thor fails that test, and that's when Odin decides he can't be king, and Thor reacts poorly and goes off and re continues to act unkingly by basically starting a war.
Yeah. I gotta give a shout out to the Warriors 3 and Sif.
Oh, yeah.
They got enough time in this movie, I feel like, to actually get like the plot through. They were just done dirty later. Like, they did their job in this movie and they weren't given more of a job.
And they never will be.
And they never will be. Shout out though to Zachary Levi, who was the original blonde Warriors 3 and not Josh Dallas of Manifest and Once Upon a Time fame. I forgot what his name was. I used to know the Warriors 3. But either way,
Fandral?
I want to say it was like Fanuel or something.
But yeah, I also like seeing Travis Willingham as those CGI frost giants.
That was Travis Willingham?
He was the mocap for the frost giants.
Holy shit.
He tells a story about he hurt his fist when he like in that shot where they jump off the ice cliff and like slam their fist into the ground. He was slamming his fist onto a concrete floor of a recording studio and hurt his hand.
That's a pretty cool story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really can't. I mean, like, the plot isn't that complicated in this movie. It's Loki betrays him, frost giants go in, loses the throne, learn how to become a better man, meets the humans, they make him better, and then by them making him better, he's finally able to pick up the hammer and defeat the one like executioner that's sent to kill him.
The destroyer armor.
Yes, which honestly, the destroyer armor, probably the coolest, like, sturdy villain that Thor's had to get in a fight
It's
with.
a really cool combat villain. Yeah, combat antagonist.
Yeah. And then I don't think we can really say enough about the dynamic between Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
as Thor and Loki. It's just great.
Yeah, the plot is fairly straightforward. Not a whole lot of twists and turns outside of like needing to give Loki those moments of deception and trickery. It does introduce the slight hiccup for later movies of if Odin has the magic to strip the power from his children and make them mortal, why didn't he do that to Hela? But who knows? But you're right, it does. This plot is straightforward enough, and the characters in it are straightforward enough to give us great moments of that Shakespeare level acting between Shakespeare giants like Anthony Hopkins and Tom Hiddleston, in that scene in the vaults when Loki confronts Odin about being adopted, basically.
I would say everything about this, you're right, just kind of all felt Shakespearean.
Yes.
And that really
And it really
just
works.
went to the benefit of the movie.
Yeah.
I do. Here's one thing I don't exactly remember. Why was Loki, like, what was his end game with the Bifrost Bridge? Because if I remember correctly, he was trying to kill all the giants.
Yes. Okay. So that's a thing. Early on in the movie, when Thor and the Warriors Three and Loki and Sif go to Jotunheim to basically get revenge on the Frost Giants for the break-in on Asgard during the coronation. Heimdall, shout out to Idris Elba, Heimdall says, I can't leave the Bifrost open because it's basically a big cannon blasting a space laser at Jotunheim, and if you leave the Bifrost open, it will destroy Jotunheim. So that's what Loki is doing at the end, to when he's like, when Odin is in the Odin sleep and he's taken over as king, he opens the Bifrost to leave it open and destroy Jotunheim. Which, if the Bifrost is a big space cannon, they're just never gonna use that again, ever?
I mean, a big space cannon doesn't seem to leave that big of an impact on any place they're going, if it's only for like a minute.
Right, it's used for transport.
It's gonna keep on getting used a lot.
Yeah.
However, point to be made, is Loki in this movie like the first villain that actually has a point for the crimes he wants to commit? Because I mean, like, most people would say, especially in like, if you're like a Norse mythology kind of person, Frost Giant's bad.
Well, the point Odin is making to Thor and Loki is that is the horrors of war, not opening your people up to war and not inflicting war unnecessarily on even your enemies. Like, because apparently, if they wanted to, they could just open up the Bifrost and leave it open on Jotunheim and it would destroy the fucking planet. But I don't really see Loki as having a point immediately. He's just angry. He just wants to prove that he is a good king by destroying any enemies of Asgard, which is the whole point that Thor is meant to learn, is that being a good king and a good warrior aren't the same thing.
Okay, true. They aren't the same thing. But, I mean, come on. Loki does have a point, though, of destroy your enemies, everybody's safer.
No, not the enemies. The point of war is to make peace with your enemies. Well, that's not the point of war. The point of a peace treaty is to make peace with your enemies. You only make peace with your enemies, not your friends.
Sure. I don't know. I feel like I'm going to start a new thing of hashtag Loki was right. Like hashtag Thanos was right.
This is why no one should trust you with a space cannon.
Nobody trusts me with a space cannon. Unless it's a space cannon that shoots out space confetti. And if anybody can tell me what space confetti actually is, please. Because I feel like it's like stellar remnants or something. Or like, you know, like dust from a nebula.
You make this sound like you've been offered a space confetti cannon.
I have not.
Okay.
Yet.
Well, I don't know anything about space confetti cannons, but I do know that a wet Chris Hemsworth having a slapdown in the mud feels like somebody's wet dream. Just had to fit that in there.
Pretty sure that was every straight woman's wet dream before Magic Mike came out.
True. Did this come out before Magic Mike? I don't even know.
I do think it did.
All right.
So, any other thoughts on this movie before we move on to, oh God, what's next? Captain America?
Captain America's next. But yeah, this movie also begins the magic and science are the same thing that will continue to debatably Doctor Strange. That's a fact. That's another setup that this movie does early on in the MCU. We mentioned how the destroyer armor is super badass. Also holding down the fight between Thor and Loki at the end, holding Loki down by putting the hammer on his chest is still funny.
Thor really didn't have to do him dirty like that. That was a decision, and it was a fantastic decision.
Yeah. And we'll get into this specific point later on when we discuss our thoughts on Ragnarok. But yeah, that whole line at the end between Odin and Thor of, you'll be a wise king someday. Psych! You're never going to be king.
He technically is king at the end of Ragnarok, going into Infinity War.
Not effectively. He doesn't rule shit.
Oh, effectively, he rules his spaceship, but another time.
For 5 minutes.
I will say, my personal opinion, other than the Avengers, which is kind of like a Joss Whedon just blend of everything that just seems to work, Thor stands out to me, especially going through all, you know, 18 years of the MCU we've had so far, as one of the best movies to blend humor.
Yeah.
I think it had really funny moments, but it was not an overly campy movie.
Yeah. Which we didn't even fucking talk about, the Jane in this movie being the motivating force behind Thor's whole character arc. But is there really much to talk about in that regard?
I don't really think so. I was going to say Jane Foster was just great. And I mean, come on. It wouldn't be Shakespearean if it wasn't, you know, main character with hubris learned from love interest how to be a better man.
That's true. That's true.
But yeah, I think that this movie blended humor with kind of a more serious tone of the movie overall, better than a lot of what we're going to get in the MCU in the future, which is why I am so sad that Kenneth Branagh will not return in the future. This is Kenneth Branagh's only outing into the MCU.
Well, he does have a voiceover role in Infinity War.
This is his only directorial outing where he has a vision, and his vision was a really good one, and one that we were all kind of had stolen from us.
I feel like this movie is the biggest example of diverse styles in the MCU before it got all, quote-unquote, forced into being the sort of MCU style that we know nowadays.
I think so. I think that's a good way to describe most of the movies in this stage one. They all were unique in their style.
Yes.
The Iron Man movies, not so much, but that was Jon Favreau for those two movies, and Jon Favreau has a very distinct style.
Yeah, but speaking of our main character becoming a good man, you know who had always been a good man, just not the perfect soldier? It's Captain America.
And the exact opposite plot, basically, of Iron Man and Thor. It's not a it's not a learning to be good. It's a learning how to be strong.
Yeah, that's a good point. But we start off this movie in the present day. I feel like starting off the movie in the present day, and then of course ending it in the present day at the when Steve wakes up out of the ice, it serves towards this framing that makes Cap feel even more out of time. And if you look really close in the background of the introductory scene in the Arctic, you can see Bruce Banner putting a gun in his mouth from that deleted scene.
Really?
No. No, that was a deleted scene in The Incredible Hulk.
Dang it, I wanted that deleted scene.
You can watch it on YouTube and hear Mark Ruffalo talk about it in Avengers. But yeah, we start off this movie in the modern day, which will eventually... is this neat sort of framing device of making Cap feel like this historical figure, which makes him feel so detached from the modern day when he wakes up in the present. And we immediately jump back to 1940s Norway with poor Argus Filch not having any magic to defend himself from Hydra when Hugo Weaving enters into this movie and will never be in another Marvel movie ever again.
Absolute disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
He should have been back for Endgame. I think the guy from The Walking Dead did great, but Hugo Weaving was just uncomfortable. In a good way.
Yeah. Yeah. The presences of these different characters and the actors is a big part of this movie. Hugo Weaving never wants to return to this character, even though he says he had a good time playing it. He just didn't want them the multi-picture deal. But Hugo Weaving is instantly a great Schmidt, instantly a great unnerving Red Skull. And on the opposite side, the tiny CGI Steve is flawless and completely convincing throughout.
You have a point.
And then we have Sebastian Stan, who... Hi, Sebastian. You'll be in this role for the rest of your life. I feel like Sebastian Stan just looks like he's from the 40s. You know, clean shaven and the hair slicked back. He just owns it. He's great.
I was going to say, he could definitely do the cleanest change between I shave, I'm, you know, a century old, I put a beard on, I look the most millennial I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it well.
Yeah. I'm also convinced that this is a trip that Clara Oswald took with the doctor before she went off on her own. Jenna Coleman at
the girl who played Clara in this?
Jenna Coleman is one of Bucky and Steve's dates. I should say Bucky's dates to the Stark Expo.
Crazy. I never knew that.
I'm convinced that this is a little go off on your own adventure that the doctor left Clara on during Peter Capaldi's time. But I also think it makes sense that I thought it was fun that, hi, Stanley Tucci. It makes sense that Stanley Tucci's character is at the Stark Expo because he'd be at the recruitment center around all the science-y shit. I thought that just made sense. But again, going into how these characters fit into the scenes they're in and the era they're in, I feel like this movie does really well at separating Steve Rogers from the overt sort of we want you patriotism of the 40s and shifts his intentions from serving his country, which is a more like America-centric idea, to his intention to fight bullies as more of a universal trait that audiences around the world can relate more heavily to.
Yeah, I definitely think that he was just kind of seen as general good guy
mm-hmm.
instead of very much the Uncle Sam kind of figure. I do think that it honestly probably worked to the movie's benefit.
Yeah, and it's also cool that the Doctor Who creates the Super Soldier Serum is an immigrant and a war refugee, which adds to that idea of greatness coming from anywhere, just like Steve. And also other figures who fit their roles really well. We eventually see Tommy Lee Jones born to play a gruff 1940s army officer.
Wait, Tommy Lee Jones, I thought was one of the scientists. Oh, he was the general.
Yep.
It was great seeing Tommy Lee Jones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Two-Face exists. I ignore that.
We can ignore that.
This movie redeemed him in superhero movies, no matter how small the role.
Certainly.
And honestly, I feel like the strength of this movie was in the first 30 minutes as like the origin story of Steve.
Okay.
And then if we're really talking about what I would say is one of the weaker attempts of the MCU, Phase 1,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think story-wise, I'd have to give it to this movie. Just because okay. I feel like it's a very, I would say almost like a very like boilerplate
mm-hmm.
kind of origin story. It's just, this is Captain America. This is how it happened. This is how he defeated the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically the Nazis.
Yes.
But yes, Hydra.
Although I will say, I like how this movie makes its villain in Red Skull and Hydra more kind of potable from an audience perspective by separating him from the Nazis, because the Hydra starts out as the research division of the Nazi party, but they rebel from Hitler, and there's even the point of Schmidt saying how he thinks Hitler's an idiot and no longer conforms to his Aryan ideals.
Yeah, I definitely think that kind of helped make it more family palatable.
Sure.
But yeah, I like the homage to the truly what would have been a 1940s suit that he wore during the USO tour. That was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, that's kind of the big thing that I remember for like that entire second third of the movie. Before you get to the Howling Commandos raid of the train.
Yeah.
That is kind of the big action moment that I remember from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Was basically the train heist.
Yeah.
And I really like that. That's also probably the saddest I had been in the death, because I really don't think there were big, like, important deaths in the MCU. Yeah, up to the point that, you know, you think Bucky is dead. Spoiler, if you haven't seen it, he's not. There are Captain America sequels.
Right.
But you definitely think he is then, unless you knew things about the comics or were, like, an 11-year-old right. child.
Yeah. Yeah, Bucky's fall during the train, the attack on the train, it even though, like, we as comic nerds knew what was going to come of Bucky later on, but outside of that, outside of the meta-knowledge, outside of the film, because they don't really, like, give you any hint that he survived, Bucky's fall is a real moment of loss in the movie, and not like a lot of other times in the rest of the MCU, we're allowed to feel that loss in the moment and in the aftermath when, you know, Steve goes to the bar afterwards in the bombed out London and has to be comforted by Agent Carter, Peggy, which we need to touch on Agent Carter. But even when Bucky comes back in future movies, the loss and the consequences of Bucky's fall is still felt, and after all he's gone through after being captured by Hydra and how hard he has to work to get through that PTSD and that mind control and the physical loss of his arm.
It led to some epic stuff, but it definitely seemed just very impossible
right.
for this not to be something bad. Yes.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was kind of the first like emotional kind of gravitas of, oh no, bad things happen in these superhero movies. Mm-hmm. I feel like they start doing it a lot more in the later movies, but it's funny how the one war movie made that takes place 60 years before all of the other ones is the only one to kind of have like that critical death moment.
Yeah.
But we're glad that happened because you're right. If we hadn't had that, then we wouldn't have gotten the cool metallic arm.
Yes, for sure. But like, again, touching on Steve's connections, Peggy is like, other than Bucky as the more present figure tying him back to his past, Peggy throughout the rest of the MCU will be that heaviest tie to the life that Steve lost. And I feel like Peggy's a great character throughout. Hayley Atwell is great throughout. And it's nice, like in this movie specifically, like we get to see the truth in Steve's character, not only in Steve's performance and Chris Evans's performance, because we get to see how other people see him and react to him even before he gets his muscles, in how like Peggy develops feelings for Steve before he becomes a super soldier. She grows to love him for his character, not because he's a badass and not even because of his big chest, though I'm sure that helps.
Yeah, I was gonna say she kind of always had something for him, even as scrawny Steve, just because he was literally the light of America kind of thing. He's like, I believe in the human race and all the great things that we can do, and that's just Captain America. I don't remember if they ever kissed in this movie. I feel like it was something that should have happened.
In the between Peggy and Steve?
Yeah.
Yeah, they kiss before they kiss at that climax scene when Steve and Peggy and the general are chasing down the Valkyrie plane that's going off to bomb America. And Steve's about to jump onto the plane, and Peggy grabs him and kisses him. And then Tommy Lee Jones is like, I'm not kissing you.
Right before everything goes bad for Steve.
Right, everything, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he got the girl, even if only for like 5 minutes of runtime.
He did. He also got, for a split second, Natalie Dormer. And that's a win. Excuse me while I drool over Natalie Dormer.
Where was Natalie Dormer in this movie? Was she his date?
She was the blonde, army soldier that like thanks Steve for saving all of those soldiers after he comes back from, it's after he strikes out from the soldier camp, goes to save Bucky and the commandos and the other soldiers behind enemy lines, and comes back and Natalie Dormer is like, a lot of those men had wives that would like to thank you and let me thank you for them kind of thing, and kisses Steve, and then Peggy gets mad and shoots at him.
I forgot how hilarious
yeah
that scene was. However, I do have to say, I remember Captain America was not a virgin, it's official. Came from She-Hulk.
Oh. Okay.
Yes, that quote came from She-Hulk, and this was something that was a huge kind of part of this episode, was arguing over this.
Okay. I have not seen She-Hulk.
Apparently Mark Ruffalo says that he was not and had lost his virginity in 1943. And I do believe that makes it so that the most logical person was Natalie Dormer.
Well, they only share one kiss before Peggy gets mad at him. And then he's immediately back on the Peggy train. And it's not like it's not like he and Natalie Dormer have a relationship. It's just like,
you don't know
Natalie
that.
Dormer wants to, I guess not. Anything could happen behind the scenes. Like something that happened behind the scenes, like Steve getting that picture of Peggy for his compass. I don't know where he got that. They're not an item.
There's a lot of Steve and Peggy things that you just gotta gloss over. It's Steve and Peggy.
That's fair.
However, one thing that I will not gloss over a second time, but the fact that Captain America doesn't win like the fight against Red Skull. I was going to say, Red Skull basically just says, I'm going to kill you with the Tesseract. And then we say, oops, guess what? It's a space thing, not a power thing. And then he just gets sucked off into space.
Bye, have a great time on Vormir.
Don't know where he went, except for once we get to Endgame. It takes us another 15 or so movies.
Well, we see him in Infinity War first when Thanos and Green Lady Gamora get there.
It still takes us so long.
Still takes us a minute. Yeah.
But yeah, we finally figure out where he went after all of those years, and he basically just became a Grim Reaper.
Which I guess maybe the origin, the truth of the Tesseract being the Space Stone makes sense, because that Valkyrie airship gets across the Atlantic in fucking no time.
So it's the marvels of German engineering.
Exactly.
But yeah, I was going to say, the thing that stuck out to me most, I think, was, I don't think there was a post-credits scene to Captain America, except for maybe just like a tease of like the Avengers movie.
It was a trailer for the Avengers, yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't anything additional. But the ending, I always kind of felt like stuck out as the, oh shit, things are getting serious, when he wakes up and then escapes into Times Square. And he's like, you're not in Kansas anymore, kind of thing. Right. I feel like that was just kind of a great ending setup to the Avengers. Mm-hmm. Thinking back, I probably couldn't have asked for like a better ending to the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really couldn't. All of S.H.I.E.L.D. really couldn't find a baseball game that aired after he went into the ice?
Not at all. They didn't try that hard. And you know Coulson wasn't the one helping him there. Coulson would have known everything.
No, he was too busy standing over his bed.
Well, I think it's time for us to move on to the last movie, which is...
I think it is time to wrap up.
Joss Whedon time.
Oh, boy. Yeah, there's a...
The Avengers, great movie.
Yes.
Shawarma is the running gag of that entire movie. Well-deserved. Shawarma's great.
Mm-hmm. Never had shawarma.
Honestly, Mediterranean food is just kind of great. You should have shawarma.
I should.
But I think the movie was just kind of packed with plot for a lot of it. It starts out with basically the heist of the Tesseract by Loki.
Right. Really nice gradual collision of stories with Eric meeting Nick and then meeting Loki and Hawkeye, etc.
Yeah, because, oh, we didn't mention that the Thor end credit scene was Eric meeting Nick and then us figuring out that Loki was mind controlling Eric.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, Clint steals the Tesseract and then they say, all right, we got to get it back. So everybody basically gets on a plane to get it back, but then, they capture Loki before that, don't they? Because then Thor shows up to beat the shit out of Loki.
They capture Loki in Germany after he has gotten away with a mind-controlled Eric and Eric and Clint and other S.H.I.E.L.D. agents.
Yeah, so they capture him, we get the Avengers can't just meet up, so they have to fight each other first.
Right.
And then we get the first view, I think, of the helicarrier in this movie.
We do.
Which, epic helicarrier is amazing. The one collectible they never released is, I think, a promotional thing for this movie was the Captain America trading cards.
Right.
I will pay somebody lots of money to get those Captain America trading cards that Coulson had.
Yeah, I bet somebody on Etsy makes them.
That would be awesome. You're going to have me searching like all weekend. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie was definitely the most comedic out of phase one. Would you agree?
I would agree for sure.
I still think it worked. And then of course you kind of had the introduction of new Banner, Mark Ruffalo, my least favorite Banner.
I can't help but disagree with you. That first scene, that first sequence with Ruffalo Banner and getting lured in by Natasha, and he's testing the waters by pretending to be angry, and she has to react and break down the deception of, oh, we're all alone, but there are S.H.I.E.L.D. agents all around us. I think it's so good.
Nah. I think that the worst mistake that was ever made was... This goes so far ahead into Endgame, which is kind of the whole Clint and Natasha battle and sacrifice. I think that was a terrible decision to make, because I think it was obvious from the first Avengers movie that the romantic Endgame of the Avengers was Bruce and Natasha, and they never finished that out for us.
Mm. So you are the rare individual who latched on to that romance early on.
Yes, I feel like that relationship was probably the most positive thing that Natasha could ever find in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, I latched onto it. Okay. I also felt like, we'll get into more in our Phase 2 episode, I feel like that was mm-hmm. one of the strongest parts of Age of Ultron as a movie. Mm-hmm. But Mark Ruffalo as Bruce Banner, not my favorite. Do I think that he had one of the strongest subplots in every Avengers movie because mm-hmm. of his relationship with Natasha? Fuck yeah, I do.
Okay. Well, I do agree with what you said about the Avengers coming to head before they legitimately team up. I feel like the conflict between the Avengers before they unite, it's so not forced when it so easily could have been. All of their reasons for being here come with conflict. Tony doesn't trust S.H.I.E.L.D. after Iron Man 2. Thor is here for Loki and S.H.I.E.L.D. needs to hold on to Loki. Steve is just trying to distract himself from mourning his past. Bruce doesn't want to Hulk out around anybody and knows that nobody trusts him on this ship. Natasha is being forced to fight her best friend. Nobody wants to be in this scenario. And the writing, the motivation behind everybody here is so strong. And I feel like that plays, that's an important part of why Coulson is an important part in this movie, and who the death of this larger side character could have been so looked over. But the fact that Coulson has been an active part in Iron Man and Iron Man 2 and Thor, and he's an active part in bringing everybody together when he's calling on Natasha, when he's talking to Clint, when he's talking to Captain America and fanboying to Cap, it really plays well into the Avengers seeing the consequences of, like with the first Iron Man movie, seeing the consequences becoming personal with somebody they know, somebody they trust, somebody who's fighting this fight for a good reason and goes down because they're butting heads and they can't agree. And they have that scene right before Clint and the mind-washed S.H.I.E.L.D. agents attack, of all of them in the laboratory, you know, butting heads and Cap telling Tony to put on the armor. It all feels believable that nobody wants to be here. Nobody likes each other. Everybody either has a past or immediately has a reason not to trust each other. And then they see where that mistrust leads them.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the point that Coulson was kind of a binding factor.
Yeah.
And that this entire movie was not a, you know, hey, team, we need you to go fight something. It's, hey, don't kill each other first, but also, ooh, trauma bond. Now, since you're trauma bonded, can you go fight something for us?
Right. Can you go save the world, please?
And get over your bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Which was just a strong way to make the movie work.
Mm-hmm.
I do wish that Loki had been killed in this movie because of how much that man pissed me off for Coulson.
Okay.
I do think that I love what has happened with Loki more in the MCU, but my immediate thought in this movie was, this man killed the best S.H.I.E.L.D. agent that exists. I need him absolutely killed.
He also has that weird eye drill scanning machine scene that gives me the heebie-jeebies.
I don't remember the eye drill.
In Germany, when he's like got to get that retinal scan for brainwashed Hawkeye to get into the S.H.I.E.L.D. facility to grab those
pieces. Yeah.
He has to drill that guy's eye in Germany.
Yeah, I remember that. That's not fun.
Nope.
But yeah, Tom Hiddleston was pure evil in this movie, more than he was in Thor.
Yeah.
They made him just objectively worse in the best way. The aliens, fun. Lots of destruction, mm-hmm. great action, gave us what we wanted in Avengers movie. The Chitauri gave us just a huge fight, and that was all we really wanted, was the Avengers kill as many aliens as possible going through New York, which was just fantastic. I do always probably compare it to the Ultimate Avengers movie.
Yeah, agreed.
And it's really hard to choose which one is better. And I think that is a benefit to this live-action Avengers movie, is that at the time, as they were building up the MCU, while not as frequent as the DC Universe's animated fare,
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Marvel had some pretty solid, like, animated movies.
Yeah.
And the fact that there was not, like, almost a steep quality decline between the live-action Avengers and the animated one, given you could show so much more in an animated movie, I think only speaks to how good Avengers was.
Yeah.
I was going to say, there's not really more specifics I have on this movie other than just it was the defining superhero movie for its time.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was the fun one.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We do get a lot of fun throughout with the fight between Iron Man and Thor in the woods. I have a note of, like, Thor gets headbutted, headbutt back. We get that fun scene, and we get the "you want me to put the hammer down" moment in that scene. We eventually get the fight on the helicarrier, which, what a fucking shot when Thor uses Mjolnir on Hulk to smack him back into that plane from True Lies. We get the Chitauri at the end, and the scene all around New York could so easily get lost in that, but centering it around Stark Tower and, again, the blue sky beam makes it really easy to follow and fun. But yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, I think two other scenes I want to point out. One, slamming Loki back and forth as Hulk, single funniest scene in that entire movie.
Puny God.
Two, because it's going to come in and actually play a decent character role in the Phase 2 movies, Tony going in and basically having, like, his, like, epic fall from grace kind of moment as he destroys all of the Chitauri and just kind of falls from the portal slow-mo. That's also a pretty great scene. But also, I don't feel like would have been that important of a scene other than, like, the visual if they didn't actually take, you know, some story development past this movie. So I think that creative choice in this movie looks better because of what they did in, specifically, it's going to be Iron Man 3 and Age of Ultron, which we'll talk about later. But that's kind of my highlights. What else? Just funny post-credits scene with the Swarma. Kobe Smulders was in this movie as Agent Hill.
Yep. Always welcome.
Ashley Johnson was apparently in this movie but had her role cut, which is an absolute travesty.
She was indeed cut. She was meant to be around as that cafe waitress to talk to Captain America. We still get to see her later on during the attack on New York. I do have a note right before that of, I can't wait for Ashley Johnson. And then my very next note is, Ashley Johnson!
Yeah. So I think that was really everything big about that movie. Also, it's part of the MCU, like, intro scroll now. Just the one the circular shot of the Avengers, just as they're all together, like, on the freeway, getting ready to disperse. Great time.
Yeah. Yeah. Just with the last few mentions just to toss in there before we wrap up, because this is a long episode. We finally get to see Sam Jackson's Nick Fury take center stage throughout this movie, which is great to see him not just playing support, but having this, you know, full frontal director of S.H.I.E.L.D. role.
But again,
what else?
This was a PG-13 movie, and they did not give their one curse word to Samuel L. Jackson to say motherfucker just once. We could get just once, but they didn't do it.
It is a crime that Chris Pratt gets the first F-bomb in the MCU and not Sam Jackson.
I feel like they should have given that man the F-bomb and an extra $5 million just to say it.
He gets an extra million for every use of the fuck word. The fuck word? The F word. But, nice to see Maria Hill. It's funny to, like you said, some funny parts. Steve making good on his betting $10 that Nick Fury can show him something he hasn't, that will surprise him. Then he gives him $10 after he sees the helicarrier for the first time. We see Agent Sitwell. We first saw Agent Sitwell, I think, in Thor, but he comes back in this movie, and then we see him as a Hydra agent in Winter Soldier.
Fuck that guy.
Yeah, fuck that guy. Tom Hiddleston is the best villain in the early MCU and will go on to be continuously one of the best villains throughout the MCU, and now a redeemed character in the MCU. He is everything he needs to be for this role. He is quiet and conversational and charming, and he is unnerved and out of balance. He is terrified and terrifying. He's amazing. The interaction between him and the German elder is great, of there will always be men like you. Amazing. I love that scene. I love that read of RDJ's of everything special about you came out of a bottle. That being said, I love most of RDJ's reads. Yeah. We could go on. There's more to say. Maybe we'll have more extended episodes for these individual movies in the future. We get to see Thanos at the end. That's something important. We get to see Thanos get all excited about courting death before the Russo brothers decided that wasn't cool enough.
I don't get why it wasn't cool enough. Like, there's literally only two people in the Marvel universe that can do it. It's Deadpool and Thanos. Also, it would have given us... Okay, I'm not going to say it because it comes up as a very recent series. If you want to see Death's introduction to the MCU, watch Agatha All Along.
Yes.
But we would have gotten more of the person who plays Death if they had just, you know, fucking grown balls and done it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But no matter.
We'll have to wait to discuss that in the future.
Yeah, but for now, Kat, any last thoughts? Last thought? Rank all of the movies.
Rank all of the movies.
From your least favorite to your favorite in this phase.
Oh my god. Least favorite, Hulk. Hulk is least favorite in phase one. I will stand by, there's not a bad movie amongst these, but if I am to rank them, Incredible Hulk at the bottom, I would say probably Iron Man 2 next, then probably Thor after that. Then Captain America and Iron Man. Do I like Iron Man or Avengers more? Do I like Iron Man or Avengers more? I can't decide. I have to choose between these my favorite children.
I can see you having an aneurysm.
Yep, it's going on. If my nose starts to bleed, let me know.
I say, well, that just means magic telepath powers. Nose bleeding's a good thing.
Oh, good. I'll say Iron Man and then Avengers is my favorite. Maybe that'll change tomorrow. Maybe that'll change in the next hour. Who knows?
My ranking is very close. My ranking is Iron Man 2, Captain America, Thor, Iron Man, and Avengers.
And you don't count the Hulk at all.
And I will not count the Hulk at all. I will not recognize it as an MCU movie. It does not deserve to get recognized. Fuck recasting of major characters.
He didn't recast after Banner. Banner just wasn't part of the MCU.
No, I'm talking about the recast between Norton and Mark Ruffalo.
I think it's an improvement. Do I still love Ed Norton?
I don't believe so, and I still believe you can't connect those two movies given that the two Banners are different. I will never see The Incredible Hulk as an MCU movie. But either way, I feel like we've had a very, very long conversation on this first phase.
Yes.
Sorry to disappoint everybody, but it will get longer and probably more depressing because this was the best string of movies that Marvel has created. True. It only goes downhill from here. But either way, there are very high points, but on average, it goes downhill. But for now, I am Cole Browning.
I'm Gavin MacArthur.
And this has been Unquestionably Nerdy. Whatever Stan Lee's catchphrase is.
Excelsior.
Excelsior.